Bruce McLaren was a New Zealand race car driver who also built cars. And he was the founder of the McLaren Car Company and that iconic brand that still is on the roads today, and a Formula One team and builders of, you know, those iconic road cars that cost ridiculous amounts of money.
Now, you were approached to make this film by the producers. Did it really take you much convincing?
Well, to make any film is a big commitment because, you know, it's, you know, a couple of years out of your life. So, you know, when I was approached about doing it, there were a number of other factors that came into play. Where was it going to be done? You know, what was the budget? You know, what was the ambition for it? And everything seemed to be, you know, in line with what I could consider to be, you know, the sort of parameters that I could work in. I live in Los Angeles, but I like the idea of going back to New Zealand where I spent many years, and my kids went to school there and, you know, worked with people I've worked with before, so it wasn't a hard decision, really.
Now, you have a great love of motorsport. How do you translate your love of motorsport via this film to people who might enjoy films and documentaries but not necessarily love motorsport?
First of all, I love motorsport, but I also love other things too. You know, it's not like I'm a petrol head that can't see beyond that. I'm as passionate about going to art galleries as I am about watching a car race. So I sort of imagine, in my mind, I've got sort of eclectic Catholic tastes that, as a filmmaker, you know, I understand the audience. Just because I'm interested in motorsport doesn't mean that the audience will be. So you have to deliver a film that expands the experience of why you would want to be interested in the guy who'd raced cars.
And what was it, the hook about Bruce McLaren, that really got you in?
Well, I think, you know, many people have heard of McLaren cars, but they wouldn't have a clue why they're called a McLaren. They wouldn't have a clue that the logo on the front of the car is a little Kiwi. And that seemed like an interesting place to start. And then, you know, he led such a brief, productive life. And sort of like someone like James Dean or Buddy Holly or Marilyn Monroe, you know, he star burned bright and then he was snuffed out at a very young age. What he managed to do in that short period of time seemed to me to be inspirational and worthy of telling his story.
What did come through to me while watching the film was that he was so well loved and respected and admired. Was there all a dark side to Bruce McLaren? Because I would imagine that someone who had achieved so much would have to have some sort of self-absorption at some point.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, the film has been criticised for being sort of, not criticised, but some people have been like, someone can't be this positive about their life. But the truth was, that is who he was. That's why he managed to, I think that's why the car company survived, was his friends were so devastated when he was killed that they were like, there's no way this name is going to die. Bruce may be dead, but the car company, the ambitions of Bruce will carry on. And I think, you know, the story of Bruce is he was an incredibly, you know, he started off life as a, you know, child who would spend 2 years in the Wilson Home for Crippled Children, was what it was called. He had a debilitating disease called Perthes disease, and he'd spend 2 years on his back. You know, he got off to a bad start, really. But I think it's just his extraordinarily positive sort of outlook on life and his determination to do something that he was crazy about and really, you know, when I say take no prisoners, I mean, he wasn't ruthless, but I think he just managed to get around him a group of like-minded individuals, and he really was an inspirational leader. And, you know, the worst thing he did was work too hard and ignore maybe his wife and family a bit, you know. But, you know, as terms of a dark side, you know, I think he's, you know, maybe he was a workaholic and, you know, those sort of people can be, you know, a little bit hard to take. But he managed to get around him people who are like-minded and was prepared to work as hard as he did, and he would do anything. In the film, there's a thing, you know, there's one of the guys says, you know, walking across the Sahara Desert, we'd be like, what time do we start, you know? That's the sort of leadership that he commanded, you know. And other people that I interviewed said versions of the same thing, you know, that Bruce really was, in a way, too good to be true.
I just wonder how a guy like Bruce would survive in today's Formula One, given that the drivers seem to, even teammates, seem to have like open contempt for each other. Has it changed?
It has changed. I think part of what's changed is that there were a small group of people. They travelled with their wives and families, you know, from race to race by road. They were like a circus, and many of them were killed. And so the women had a support group called, I think, the Doghouse Club, which was really a club of the wives to sort of support each other in the event of tragedy overtaking their husbands. It was a very tight, unique group of people, and nothing like it is now.
When you first started making the documentary, what elements were you particularly looking for? Were you looking for footage or audio or?
Well, early on, I discovered something that was quite unique to build this documentary around. Bruce, when he went to the UK, would make tapes and send them back to his family and with some of his friends as well, with, you know, Wally Wilmot and the other young guys that he went to England with. They would make tapes and send them back home. And his parents would make tapes of and send them back to him so that he would know what was going on back in New Zealand. And so rather than being sort of interviews tapes, these were just stories, you know, these were a very personal tapes between father and son, mother and son, and backwards and forwards. That seemed to me to provide a very unique perspective to base this film on, and I think part of that is why it does feel personal, the story.
Also, there are some recreations of events in this documentary. I just wanted to ask you about why you felt it necessary to recreate some events.
Well, here's an example. You know, there was one tape that was a tape that his parents made on his 21st birthday. They were back in New Zealand. He was when they had the party for him in New Zealand, he was racing his car in the UK. So they made a tape and everybody's wishing him happy birthday and they sing him happy birthday. There was no visuals to go with that. So what I did was I, you know, shot a birthday party scene that was like, you know, looked like it was, in fact, many of the people in the recreation were his relatives, his sister and people like that. So it was stuff like that. You know, I had this real tape from their time and to give it some visuals to go with it.
I'm just wondering, is that because today's audience need to have these gaps filled in for them? Are they lack of imagination from the audience?
This is just the way I decided to solve the problem, you know. I mean, hopefully it's not boring. Hopefully you're not thinking this is a recreation. Hopefully you're just listening to the story and you get involved in his story. You know, I call it a documentary about Bruce's life, and I try to tell the truth using the material I have, and where there's holes, you know, some stuff's got to get filled out.
Okay, there were a couple of other recreations, particularly when one of his teammates has the crash and gets badly burned.
Right.
When I was watching it at the time, I didn't realise I was actually watching a recreation.
Good, because I went to a lot of trouble to, you know, try and, I mean, first of all, I exhaustively, you know, searched the archives to see if I could find any footage of this. And there was nothing. And then I thought, well, you know, we could recreate something. So we recreated the car. This particular Indianapolis model car does not exist. So I had to recreate it. So, you know, I got these guys whose life is McLaren, you know, restoring old McLarens. And they built the back of this car so it looks identical to the real car. We got some pictures of it and blew them up big. And, you know, so it was a real effort went into recreating this. And then we shot some stuff that, you know, you wouldn't know unless you know that it's not the real thing.
It blended in beautifully.
Yeah.
One of your first films was a documentary about New Zealand motorcyclist Bert Munro, which eventually became the feature film The World's Fastest Indian.
Yeah.
Could you see that happening with this film?
Oh, I don't know. Who knows? I mean, The World's Fastest Indian, it was one of my very early films. Most of it was shot on a Bolex, you know, spring wind Bolex. And I had, you know, made this documentary that definitely captured the spirit of the real guy, but there was so much more to be told, I felt. And so, you know, I thought, you know, and nobody had a clue who Bert Munro was around the world. Nobody had ever heard of him, including everybody in New Zealand. So I just thought, yeah, it's something unusual, different. I wrote a script. It took me 20-something years to get the thing, you know, financed. I tried many different versions of the script. But in the end, you know, I did get it made, and half of that was just getting Tony Hopkins to come on board and play the character of Bert. But it was a very satisfying sort of experience to make something that was an extension of my filmmaking career from the 70s to 2005 when it came out.
Mm-hmm. What style of film do you prefer, making documentaries or making fictional feature films?
What I do try and do is make every experience a different one. You know, I don't want it to be Groundhog Day where I just make the same movie again and again and again. I mean, probably the most interesting films I've ever made have been some of those big, giant movies like 13 Days or Dante's Peak, because, you know, they really do, that's fun filmmaking, you know, that's really creating big stuff and ambitious stuff and getting it on the screen, you know.
But again, 13 Days was loosely based around factual incidents.
No. And even, you know, Dante's Peak, you know, I started out life as a geologist, and so I was interested in the geology of that story, you know. I'm always looking for something that just hooks me on the story, you know, something that I've got a particular, I mean, here's an example. you'd say, well, what was your interest in Species, you know, apart from young naked women? That wasn't why I did it. You know, what I was interested in was in the SETI project, you know, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence that Carl Sagan, you know, started. There's those Voyager spacecraft that are still going away from Earth, billions of miles away from our planet now, with all this information about our life here on Earth on this disc that they put on board it. I was just interested in the what if. I went down and shot some of it at Arecibo in Puerto Rico. I was there and watching the guys, you know, scanning the heavens for any stuff. It was just like I was got into something I was interested in.